Hit it.
Hey, everyone. In today's episode of the Left of Boom show, I interview Dave Sapanoff, senior consultant with LRI Consulting Services. He's one of our go-to resources when it comes to collective bargaining in general, and especially in bargaining first contracts. And today's episode is all about what does an employer do in that period between losing an election and then getting ready to start their collective bargaining. Dave's got a lot of practical tips around, first of all, just the environment, the maintaining the status quo environment that's so critical during this period. What do you train your supervisors to do during this period so that they understand like what legally has changed now that there is a exclusive bargaining relationship? Also a lot of practical tips around how do I figure out what my team should be, who should be on that team, how do I get them prepared? And then finally, like what are some of the first moves to expect from the union? And how do you kind of get ready and know how to respond to those moves? Again, a lot of great practical advice here. So enjoy this episode with Dave Sapanoff. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to see you. As you know, our episode today is all around kind of like you've just lost an election and you have a bargaining obligation with the union. And so let's just dive in with, you know, how do you help clients that are in that kind of a situation? They've just lost an election and now need to kind of get ready for bargaining.
I think for most clients, you know, most management teams, the biggest question after having lost an election is now what? You know, what happens now? Where do we go? Really, what initiates the whole process of bargaining? And, you know, so at this point in time, you've lost an election. What will happen is typically about a week, 10 days later, you'll get official notice from the NLRB certifying the results of the election. And then very shortly thereafter, management should expect a communication from the union, be it in letter form, be it in an email, to basically initiate collective bargaining with the employer. So in effect, they'll ask for, you know, restate the fact that they are the sole and exclusive representative of the employees. They'll ask to start coordinating calendars to establish a bargaining schedule. Typically, they will also include an information request, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that includes as we talk through this. And generally speaking, in most communications, that initial communication from the union, there'll be an admonition to management that management is required to maintain what is known as the status quo. So that's really the initial steps in the bargaining process and what management can expect to happen within about 2 to 3 weeks after the election has been conducted.
Great. Now, I should have started here. How do you know all this? Tell us a little bit about your background.
I've been in labor relations practically all my adult life. I have a bachelor's degree in economics from State University of New York in Cortland. After graduating from there, I went to work for the Teamsters Union in New York City. I was an organizer field representative for one of the largest industrial Teamster locals in the New York metropolitan area, and I did that for a little over 6 years. Then got my master's degree in industrial and labor relations from New York Institute of Technology and made the switch over from the labor side of the table over to the management side. Worked for 34 years with Sprint Communications and its derivative companies. For the most part, I was in HR and director of employee and labor relations. Sprint, at the time I was with them, we had 35 collective bargaining agreements. A little over 12,000 bargaining unit members in 18 states. And I was responsible for the basically the care and feeding of the bargaining units and also for keeping 45,000 non-union employees non-union.
So a lot of bargaining experience.
In 2018.
Yeah, and a lot of bargaining experience. And then you've been doing it, you know, as a consultant then for a number of years as well.
But for the most part, all with LRI since 2018.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're one of the sort of go-to folks when we have clients that want, want our help in bargaining a contract. You're one of the first people I turn to. So let's go back. You mentioned a lot of stuff in the lead up there. So why don't we start with status quo? I think that's kind of a core concept that a lot of people don't know. And if you haven't, been unionized before and you're a company, we're in this market now where there's a lot of union elections happening. They're happening with a lot of smaller companies. And so there's a lot of companies who are facing this situation for the first time and maybe don't have a lot of background or knowledge about kind of what to do. So let's talk about this idea of status quo. Just explain kind of, I just lost an election. I know I'm gonna have to do bargaining, but that could take a long time. Like, what are the rules, during that period?
Really, what status quo is, it's sort of an extension of during the election campaign, that concept of laboratory conditions, where during the election campaign, if you made unilateral changes to wages, benefits, terms and conditions of employment, either gave something to the employees or took something away from the employees, that would constitute a violation of the National Labor Relations Act. Likewise, after the election, management is in effect required to operate under the same policies and procedures that were in effect prior to the election. So this means status quo means you maintain all your current practices and policies, and that management is generally prohibited from making any unilateral changes in terms of conditions of employment during that bargaining period. Now, there's some kind of difficult concepts in there because, for argument's sake, what happens if you had a wage increase scheduled during that period of time? This is sort of a recent change in NLRB philosophy, but status quo, if you had been giving out a wage increase at the same time every year for multiple years in a row, you would typically continue with that because that is part of status quo. Under recent NLRB doctrine, however, things have changed within the last year, year and a half, that would basically say, even if you have this scheduled wage change due to happen, you would still, in effect, have to bargain that with the union now. So bottom line is you manage with the policies and practices that you carried into and past the election, and you cannot make any unilateral changes to wages, benefits, terms and conditions of employment.
Yeah, so this is a really tricky area. And like you said, the law has recently changed here. And there is kind of there's a legal question, and then there's also kind of a bargaining strategy question that goes along with it. So just to sort of sum up what you just said, if there's something that you've done that's not discretionary, that's kind of like the main thing that they like to focus on. If you were doing something and have done it historically, let's say, for example, you have, every year all the classifications get a 25 cent an hour increase. And that's been your history and that's how it's happened. And it's always the same amount. That's a non-discretionary increase. And even if maybe the employer could say, we're not going to do it this year, they haven't done that historically, it's always been kind of the same, that's really non-discretionary, that's going to be very difficult for you to stop doing. If you stop doing that, that's going to be, like you just said, it sort of violates this laboratory conditions status quo environment. On the other hand, if you gave out merit increases, and it could be a range from, 3 to 7% or something, and that was kind of what you had done, and individuals might get something inside of that range, that now is much more discretionary. And so that would fall into this category of things where it's you can't do something that's discretionary without first bargaining with the union. Now, unions and companies can agree to things even before you get a complete contract negotiated. And so they could, for example, say, we want to continue to do this discretionary increase, and it's always been in a range like this, and we'll agree to keep it in a range like that, but we want to keep doing it the way that we were doing it, which is basically at our discretion. A union could say yes to that, and then the employer would be able to do it. Now, most of the time, unions don't like that, right? They want to make it, they'd rather that be sort of part of the whole package. So this is where it becomes kind of a bargaining strategy component. Maybe walk us through a little bit some experiences you've had where it's like, we have to decide, you know, there is this thing, maybe it's discretionary, maybe we could argue it's not. Like, how does that play out in real life?
There are very few unions that will throw themselves in front of a wage increase, regardless whether they negotiated it or not. I think the main thing for management to understand is that if there was a regularly scheduled wage increase or some discretionary merit increase that was due the employees, the union will typically not step in the way of that, but in effect will tell the employees, look at that money as a down payment. Mm-hmm. We'll add on top of that. And quite frankly, management will not get credit for that at the bargaining table. I've been through multiple situations on both sides of the table where we've gone through those types of scenarios. And in terms of when it gets down to bargaining wages, you know, management may bring up the issue, well, look, this year alone, we already gave out a 3.5% wage increase. And as far as the union is concerned, I'm going to say 99% of the time, they'll basically say, we don't care. Mm-hmm. We're basically looking for more, and you did what you had to do, and we're going to continue to bargain on top of that. So it's kind of for the management team, it's kind of a lose-lose situation. You're putting money out there ahead of reaching an agreement, and again, you're not going to get a heck of a lot of credit from the union.
Yeah.
One other thing too about this whole status quo is that many unions will use this as sort of a leverage point. And by that I mean is, let's say you have something at the company that's not working well. Attendance is an issue, for instance, and you were thinking about instituting some form of an attendance policy or program. The fact that you cannot do that during bargaining, in a sense, puts management in the position of being prohibited sometimes from doing certain things. One other thing, and even though it's technically outside the realm of terms and conditions of employment, you may have with some more aggressive unions, you have an operational change you want to put into effect. The union may demand that you bargain with them over the impact of that operational change on the bargaining unit. And as a result of that, sometimes management finds themselves hamstrung in terms of even implementing some basic operational changes during the bargaining period. And the unions see that and will use that as leverage at the bargaining table.
Yeah, good points. I think, you know, because of what you just said, this sort of highlights a little bit of the bargaining strategy side of this, which is that because the union is going to basically just take anything that happens sort of before a contract and like not really bake that into whatever like the final agreement is, then the employer ideally would like to hold all that stuff off until you get to a final deal. And so that it is all baked into that final agreement. So that's sort of like, that's generally what the employer wants to do. Now, during COVID and in other situations in the labor market, there's many times where the employer really desperately wants to, you know, like we can't attract talent unless we implement some sort of a wage increase. Then they have an incentive to try to do it in the middle of the, or during the bargaining sessions. And oftentimes if unions see that, they might say no, because they want the leverage of, you know, for getting other things that they want in exchange for something the employer wants. So there's this whole back and forth in the bargaining strategy. It becomes very, you know, specific to the employer's situation, you know, sort of how does the union feel about their strength with this bargaining unit? How quickly do they want to get a deal? There's a lot of other kind of factors that go into this, right?
I mean, what I saw, you know, you bring up a good point, like during the COVID period, you're absolutely right. A lot of unionized employers went to their unions and said, look, we're having difficulty attracting people. And we would like to institute the following policies, the following procedures, or a wage increase in order to make ourselves more attractive in the marketplace. what a lot of employers found was that the unions were agreeable to that, but not agreeable to the numbers. And as a result, you saw during the COVID period a lot of basic wage increases that far exceeded anything else that had done before. And then so, you know, as soon as the COVID scenario was over with, a lot of employers found themselves carrying a fairly heavy economic burden from something they had negotiated with the union during COVID. So, you know, again, you bring up a very valid point, which is anytime you reopen a contract midstream, you open yourself to a lot of unanticipated issues. You know, put it under the column of no good deed goes unpunished, but unfortunately, that's what happens.
Yeah. And there's a lot of situations. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, unionized workplaces fell behind during COVID. And that's because, you know, a non-union workplace, they were able to adjust wages sort of like on the fly as needed. They could make a lot of different adjustments. If you're in this bargaining situation, you're sort of stuck. You, like, if you can't get the union to agree, or if you say we want to do X and the union says we want to do X plus Y and you don't want that, then the employer doesn't have to make the change. They can just say, well, we'll just stick with what we currently have. And so you had a lot of situations where there were definitely situations where the unions were agreeable and contracts were reopened and things changed. But you can also get into that situation where it's like, look, we'll just wait till the contract reopens at the end of this expiration. And yeah, we'll see where we are at that point. So there's a lot of, again, it just comes down to leverage and sort of what are the goals of everybody. But you have to kind of, if you don't come to some agreement, then you're stuck with status quo, whether that status quo is a current collective bargaining agreement in place or what we're talking about today, which is, you know, the procedures and the working conditions and the situation that was in place before the union was voted in, that stuff has to stay until there's been something else bargained.
That's absolutely correct. And again, it tends to hamstring management to a certain point, you know, especially if the organization is kind of in a state of flux. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm dealing with a client right now they had to initiate a lot of operational changes. An election occurred midstream. The union is extremely aggressive in effect, admonishing management to maintain status quo. And literally every operational change that this employer has wanted to institute, you know, we're talking about different billing procedures. We're talking about just how work is handed off from one group to the other, has resulted in a demand from the union to bargain, in effect, the effect mm-hmm. of all these changes on the terms and conditions of employment of the employees in the unit. And in effect, if it constitutes a change in their term and condition, then the employer technically hasn't maintained status quo. And that's a violation of the act. So it puts management in a very difficult place sometimes.
Yeah. Let me sum up this part with just, you know, it's really complicated. We'll talk in a minute about kind of like, how do you get advice during this period? But like the bottom line is this idea of like, what status quo, what are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to change? Like during this period is a complicated question. It's a legal question. And then there's also a sort of strategic component to it. And if you haven't done it before, the bottom line is like, you really need to be thoughtful about any sort of change that happens, you know, during that period. And we'll get into sort of like what's the team that you might want to have, you know, on your team to help you through all that. But like that's sort of the big picture idea. Now I want to switch gears for a second and talk a little bit about, you know, during this period, you know, the group that's sort of is often like the most in the dark is the supervisors. So you've got like a group of managers who've never operated in a unionized environment before. And they don't necessarily understand all the status quo stuff and sort of things like that. Why don't you walk through like, what should management be doing to, you know, educate frontline leaders and even, you know, mid-level managers about operating in a newly unionized environment?
You know, this is, also represents one of the larger changes that management has to deal with. You know what I mean? Typically after an election, there's a change in the relationship with the employees. And, you know, again, depending on the nature of the election, depending on the employee group, generally what you see is a change in the attitude and behaviors of the employees themselves towards management. In effect, they'll start acting like they are union. And that often represents new challenges for the frontline supervisors. In other words, you may have some of your more active union supporters start acting out, things of quote, wanting to negotiate, you know, directions given to them on the floor. You may have groups of employees now talking about, you know, filing grievances when, and quite frankly, no grievance process exists. But they'll talk about formally filing grievances. You may have spokespersons evolving. And one of the other things that's very important for the frontline supervisors to understand, and again, this isn't generally well known or used in a non-union environment, but basically where an employee, when you're interviewing an employee and the employee has a reasonable expectation that that discussion is going to lead to discipline, they are entitled to a representative at that meeting. Now, generally known as Weingarten rights. What you typically see is after an election is won, the employees themselves have been advised of this by the union and begin exercising that right. So now every time management goes and talks to one of their employees and sits down and says, look, you know, your work hasn't been up to standard or there was a mistake made or something like that, you'll find employees then saying, I want a representative at this. This is going to lead to discipline. And again, that sort of puts frontline management out of sorts. So the main thing is educating supervision on how to deal with that type of activity, what we call protected concerted activity, where employees, one or more employees are acting on behalf or for mutual aid and protection of themselves, in effect on how to deal with that so that they do not violate the National Labor Relations Act. One of the first things I always tell management, however, is during this period, don't cede rights. And in effect, manage your business. And that's really the most critical thing that they can do here is number one, hold people to performance standards, hold people to attendance standards, hold people to all the other policies and procedures that are part of status quo, and in effect, make sure that the business gets run. Don't be afraid to manage people actively. And if the union, you know, intercedes or demands, you know, let me give you an example. Let's say you disciplined an employee, terminated an employee. You know, the union may demand to negotiate over that action that you took. The simple fact of the matter is that, you know, at that point, you'll respond to the union and say, thank you very much. You know, what do you need to know about it? We're willing to provide you with that information, but we were acting within status quo and leave it at that. So the main thing at this juncture then also is educating your frontline supervision, much like you educated them on tips during the election campaign, tips is still in effect. If management is, or supervisors for that
instance. Why don't you spell out, what does tips mean real quick?
Tips means you cannot threaten, interrogate, make promises, or engage in spying or surveillance on an employee's union activities. So for instance, then, you know, even after the election, threatening employees who are engaged in union activities with disciplinary action where, you know, that was a protected, concerted activity of theirs, again, would violate the law. One of the bigger things here is, in effect, people start to, you know, conjure up all sorts of concepts and ideas of what's going to come out of bargaining. And again, you want to make sure that both management and the supervisors, the mid-level management and supervisors understand, in effect, you know, what could constitute illegal speech from, you know, a bargaining perspective. In other words, you know, saying, you know, to an employee, a supervisor says to an employee, you know, the company's never going to agree to anything the union says. They're just going to say no, and they'll never be in agreement. So in a sense, then saying things that give the, invoke an intention of management not to engage in good faith bargaining would be a violation of the act. So you want to make sure that your supervision and your mid-level management are all trained on that as well. What is legal speech? What is illegal speech?
Yeah, let me kind of sum that up. And of course, we've got a book on this, right? Managing in a Union Shop. And
yes.
And you know, and you train management teams on this all the time, whether they already have a contract and been unionized for years. A lot of times supervisors still don't even understand this playing field. But if you're newly unionized, you have no idea like how any of this stuff works. And you really need to get a primer on some of these core rules. And so those core rules are, you still run the business. You
yes.
still follow your policies and procedures. During the status quo period, it's an unfair labor practice to stop following those policies and procedures. So like you continue to manage the business. Just because a union doesn't like it or an employee doesn't like it, like they can object, they can ask to have a meeting about it, they can ask to have a representative in that meeting. You cannot deny them that. That's something that's changed that wasn't really in place when you were non-union that now is in place. If I say I want my steward in a meeting with me, like you have an obligation. If there's any disciplinary action that can come out of this meeting, you have an obligation to allow them to have that that representative. So those are kind of key changes that if you don't really understand that playing field, it could be super easy to just sort of try to do things the way that you used to that could really harm the company and could lead to you being found guilty of an unfair labor practice, right?
Or not do anything at all, which is, in a sense, you're ceding it. The employees start objecting to what you're asking them to do. And, the supervisors put their hands up and say, well, all right, I don't want to do anything that's going to violate the law. So in effect, the employees start dictating how the shop floor, for lack of a better term, gets run. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge mistake for management that, this early on, in order to see that level of, power and right to the bargaining unit members.
There's also a risk there of erosion, right? So like if management isn't enforcing its rules and isn't like following through on what it is supposed to be doing, there's on the one side that can be an unfair labor practice. In other words, that could be considered like a change. So like if the union doesn't like, thing you're not enforcing, they can object to that as saying like, well, that's a change in circumstances. That's violating status quo. The flip side is also true. If there's something they don't like, which is a rule that is in place and you stop enforcing that rule because they're complaining about it, you can actually lose the right to enforce that rule in the future because you've created a past practice of now no longer following that rule. So it's really important for leaders to understand in this new environment, you need to follow the rules that are on the page. And don't be sort of, intimidated out of following those rules, and don't, change the rules, while you're in this period of status quo. You just follow the rules.
I think for a lot of management, one of the more difficult aspects of this is, in a sense, developing the discipline to deal with this. It requires a lot of extra work, a lot of extra effort. Bottom line is during this period or during the contract, you're absolutely correct that if management does not enforce their current policies or doesn't enforce something that was negotiated into the agreement, in effect, what they're doing is they're ceding rights or creating a binding past practice, which can work against them as well.
Yeah. So now let's switch gears now. So we've got kind of like these two main things we've talked about so far. The first thing is this big idea of status quo, and that's the main thing that you need to have sort of on your radar during this whole period. And then the second thing is that we need our supervisors to understand that they're in this changed environment and kind of how to operate in that changed environment, which means you need to train them. And then now let's talk about like, what's the team? Like who do I lean on? And here, I think you have really employers of various stages and various sophistication when you get into a situation like this where you've lost an election. So some employers are big and they already have like internal expertise, and they may already have an internal team that can do this. So they're kind of, there's people that are at that end. Most people don't have that, especially smaller employers. A lot of the people that are being targeted these days aren't in that position. So they don't have really in-house expertise at this. You might have somebody that has dealt with a union at some point, but generally you don't have anybody like whose job is to do that. And so in that case, you've got to figure out kind of like who your team is. Why don't you talk a little bit about sort of different ways that you have kind of fit into employers that are in that situation?
Absolutely. You know, again, that's one of the first things that management has to do is, in a sense of heading into this bargaining phase, is to try and understand, you know, how will they handle it? Who will handle it? Initially, one of the things you want to do is, as soon as you're contacted by the union, it's very important that at least at that juncture, you establish, you know, a single point of contact. And in effect, so this way, all communications from the union are going to a single person, and that person at least initially has the responsibility, for argument's sake, on an information request. I don't want to, you know, underplay what the importance of timely responding to a union's information request, and we can talk about that in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it's important that they all come in. One person is responsible for handling it. As you go into the actual bargaining phase, then management philosophically, as you point out, wants to start asking themselves, you know, do we have the internal expertise? Do we want to involve a lawyer in terms of being our spokesperson or representative at the table? Do we want to involve an outside consultant, somebody like myself who has been through this? Or do we handle it internally, you know, amongst ourselves here? And again, that's sort of, it's based on the skill set that's incumbent at the company. So again, you know, it's important. If the skill set isn't there, generally speaking, what I have done in terms of being engaged as a consultant, I've acted as first chair, that is the chief spokesperson for the company. I've acted as sort of an individual sitting next to the chief spokesperson for the company, which is typically an operations person or somebody, you know, higher up in the organization. And in effect, you know, work out all the, you know, the signals and signs in terms of stopping conversations, things of that nature, and advising them live at the table. I've sat in a room away from the bargaining, and in effect, as the bargaining occurs and teams come back on caucus or breaks, we then walk through what was said, how to then respond, things of that nature. If management doesn't want, you know, sometimes they don't want somebody from outside the organization at the table. So done it all different ways, and it's all based on client needs, desires, skills. And you know, again, that's all part of the evaluation process as you head into bargaining.
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize too, there's always a lawyer involved at some level, whether that and lawyers will sometimes be involved like sitting at the bargaining table. So instead of a consultant, you might have your lawyer sit at the bargaining table. Some lawyers really like to do that. Many don't. The challenge with sitting at the bargaining table is you're like a witness to everything that's happening in that room. And so you can end up, if there's an unfair labor practice charges filed or whatever, you can end up like not really being able to represent because like you are a fact witness to everything that's been happening. So because of that, many lawyers like to sort of, I like to think of it as like being the offensive coordinator of, you know, of bargaining. So like the example you said of like sitting in the room outside, you can review things, you can go through strategy, you can develop the, you know, the proposals or like the plays that you're going to play. But you're not actually like on the field. So that's a second way that happens. And in those cases, many times they might ask us to be in the room and do the first chair negotiating. But they're involved in sort of helping direct the strategy. And again, of course, there's a lot of like legal advice that happens during this period as well. you know, the actual bargaining of the contract isn't really legal advice, but like the, you know, making sure that we are offering, you know, proposals and counter proposals that are not going to make us at risk of unfair bargaining charges. You've already talked about the timing of things. You know, the big watch outs for employers during this whole bargaining process is you want to be seen as bargaining in good faith. That doesn't mean that you have to agree to things that the union's proposing. That doesn't mean that you have to like give in on things that are really important to you, but it does mean you have to meet with them regularly. You have to exchange proposals. You have to attempt to reach an agreement. Sometimes that's possible. Sometimes that's not possible, but like you have to go through all of the steps to make sure that you can prove like, look, we've attempted to reach an agreement. And so things like what you brought up, the union's made an information request and we sat on it for a long time. That's not bargaining in good faith. Now, you may respond to that information request by saying like these four items on here, we don't think we have to answer. We don't think that they're reasonable or related to the bargaining, but you need to respond, you know, quickly once you've sort of reviewed the request and go, these ones we're working on, these ones we don't think we have to respond to. And these we will respond to, but we're going to respond to them differently. Like that would be an appropriate response. So you have this like legal stuff that's happening where you want to make sure that you're getting advice around how do I avoid bad faith bargaining charges. You have the just tactical what's happening in the room and who's going to be like delivering those messages. And then the last thing, there's also, you know, even if you have somebody who could theoretically be your first chair spokesperson that is employed by your company, this takes a ton of time. And so like, can they sort of stop doing their day job for the hours and hours and hours it takes to negotiate a first contract? You know, that's another component to the sort of figuring out like who's, you know, who's on the team, right?
I mean, absolutely. And again, it's, you know, for employers that have never been through this process before, you know, let's go back to information requests. Now, it's like, it's a daunting task because generally speaking, you're going to get about a 2 to 3 page information request. Usually that's a very basic request from the union. And again, in advising employers, a lot of them take, you know, we'll look at this and say, oh my God, this is onerous. I'm not going to respond to this. Well, you know, my job is to basically say, look, they're entitled to this information legally. You need to respond, regardless of the amount of time it may take for you to do that. Some of the information, as you pointed out, Phil, you know, has a relevancy issue to it. And again, there's both an art and a science, in a sense, to challenging a union in terms of their information requests as to whether or not it's relevant to the bargaining unit or not. You know, I'll give an example. You know, in negotiations now, where the union there has the unit that they're bargaining on behalf of received ostensibly a 10-page information request from the union, and half of the information request was about another unit of employees that was not part of the bargaining unit.
Yeah.
The two groups were connected by there's a handoff in information from one group to the other. And what the union was trying to do at that point was to claim that the demand for information on the non-bargaining unit was relevant because of this handoff that occurs between the two groups. And again, we consulted with an attorney on that to make sure that when we responded to the union, that we basically were clear that this group and their information request about this group was not relevant to these negotiations. Likewise, the union may ask for financial information. And again, this is one of those other nuances where, you know, in effect, you have a frontline supervisor, a mid-level manager, even somebody in upper management saying, you know, hey, if we go to the bargaining table and the union asks us for X, Y, and Z, we're out of business. Management has to understand that, in a sense, this concept of, quote, pleading poverty, or that a union request may put them out of business, puts them at legal risk for the union potentially asking the company or the organization to open its books to them. So again, there's a lot of nuances in all of this, so that when the union asks for what appears to be, close held information, you know, this idea of responding in a way that says, hey, This is confidential information. And again, more aggressive unions may at that point say, all right, we recognize that we're willing to negotiate over a confidentiality agreement so that you can reveal this. And again, this is where the attorneys really are best suited to guide that sort of conversation and whether or not the information is truly confidential, not confidential, or what should go into a confidentiality agreement. And again, this is getting into a lot of detail, but this is how nuanced some of this comes during even the initial phases of bargaining.
Yeah, for someone listening, we've got multiple episodes coming. We're not going to get too much deep. We're already pretty deep into it, but we're not going to get too much deeper into like the actual sort of tactical bargaining. We're going to do a whole episode on that. And we're going to do an episode on preparing for bargaining. So we're not going to get into all the details, but just like big picture, there is this whole bucket around, you know, you have to be prepared to go into bargaining. Again, without going into a lot of the details of it, just sort of big picture, what are the kinds of things that an employer who's never been into bargaining before needs to be thinking about doing to prepare for upcoming bargaining?
You know, one of the first things I want to, you know, I always advise management of this heading into bargaining, because a lot of them head into bargaining with this expectation that they sit at the table and listen to the union make demands on them. And that their sole responsibility here is to respond to union demands. I always tell employers, bargaining is a two-way street. The union will have its demands. You need to go to the table as well with your own demands. In effect, look at this as an opportunity to fix operational issues, HR issues, things that haven't been working for you. Look at this as an absolute opportunity to fix those things at the bargaining table. So in effect, what that says is, you know, one of the first exercises I have management going through is, regardless of what the union may ask for, what are the things that are important for you to maintain and be able to manage even in a, you know, a unionized environment? Once you have an agreement, what needs to be in that agreement that will help you to operate the business? What problems do you want to fix? Second is to always have the employer basically do sort of an assessment, an economic assessment of their organization, the outside marketplace, how competitive they are, where they want to be in the marketplace, things of that nature. Also, to go through some fairly significant information gathering. So in other words, at this juncture, you want to, you know, again, at least start understanding what is the union likely to show up with at the bargaining table in terms of initial demands. Generally speaking, in the first meeting, the union typically walks in with a completely mocked up agreement that represents, in effect, their best language from all their other agreements. So all to develop all this understanding. Then you start looking at, in effect, setting up your team. And that's identifying, again, who will be your chief spokesperson, first chair. Generally speaking, depending on the size of the organization, you generally want to have somebody who is operationally competent over the group, somebody who understands the mechanics of that group and how that group operates. Second, I typically like to have an HR type person at the table if that is within the organization. So that person, in effect, because a lot of what the conversation is going to be about is policies, procedures, terms and conditions of employment for the employees. And generally speaking, I also like to have somebody who has financial acumen at the table. And again, I don't like to have, and will typically tell the employer, don't have the senior most person in any of those organizations at the table. Because in effect, you want to maintain what I call some level of hidden authority. You know, somebody may have to go back and ask for permission on something. And then, first and foremost, somebody at the table that can take notes. And I don't want to, you know, diminish that. It's really the group that keeps the best notes are the ones that generally, you know, do the best. So that typically is what your team looks like, okay?
And I think, just to be clear, like they don't have to all be in every single session. So you can have some sessions where, you know, we're going to be talking, this one's going to all be about policy stuff. So we need the HR person, but the finance person doesn't necessarily have to be there. And then this meeting we know is going to be all about the economics. So we have to have the finance person there. You can mix up the team a little bit, sort of based on what you anticipate is going to get negotiated.
Yes.
I think that's a great sort of, you know, layout of kind of what happens. We talk about information requests, but it's also important, like we can make information requests of the union as well. So each party can ask, you know, for information. And then there's this sort of, you know, bigger picture. Ideally, we want to reach an agreement that is going to be as favorable for us as it can be. The union, of course, is wanting to do the same thing. So then you have to start figuring out, okay, like what's our strategy to get there? One thing I forgot to ask. So you said like the union shows up with kind of like their language, and their language, you know, their language is coming from other contracts that they've negotiated where they're like, oh, this is a really good clause. Let's try to get that in all of our other agreements. On the management side, where do those words come from? Where does management go find kind of like their favorite contract clauses?
That's typically, you know, the main role of either the attorney or the consultant is to supply management with that basic information. A lot of this is also available online. You can find a lot of boilerplate language. The main thing I always tell management, however, is this, is that, you know, the union's going to come in with typically boilerplate language, their best language from any number of their agreements. And I always tell management, don't let the union force fit you into their model of what a union shop looks like. You are a unique organization with unique needs. Do not be afraid to demand to negotiate unique language that suits your operation. Okay.
Right.
And again, so that's typically why a lot of companies will turn to a consultant or an attorney, because of just the breadth of knowledge of different contract language clauses, what's available out there. You know, you can find examples of contracts on, you know, on the Department of Labor website, FMCS. A lot of contracts are out there, but, you know, typically, you know, on the web, but typically, again, the consultants are the ones that, you know specific industries, know specific unions, and can pull that information for the employer and find good language or design language for them that suits their operational needs.
Yeah. I'd be remiss if I didn't also mention my book on model contract clauses, but if you're somebody that is like thinking about doing this on your own, which I wouldn't really advise, but let's just say you're like, I'm going to try this on my own. The way that I developed that book, you know, you can go grab whatever contract language you want off of like whatever website you want, but you really don't know like what's a good clause look like and what's a bad clause look like and why. And the whole point of that book that I did is to have on each topic examples of, this is what a pro-union clause looks like. This is what, you know, it's sort of like the, you know, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. So like, this is pretty favorable to the union. This is maybe too favorable to management, but like, this is what a really strong pro-management clause looks like. And then here's one that's kind of down the middle. And the point of that is just sort of get yourself to a point where you can, you know, you can evaluate what good language looks like versus bad language once you sort of understand what it is the union's going for, and then what does a really strong management clause look like.
I mean, absolutely. And, you know, this is something that I would say for management that have never worked with a union agreement before, this is probably the most daunting thing, because, you know, labor agreement language, contract language is so nuanced, you know, for argument's sake, you know, a sentence that, you know, let's just say overtime will be calculated for a week if an employee worked a paid holiday or took a vacation day, that holidays and vacation count towards the overtime bill, period. Mm-hmm. That same sentence, if I say, The overtime calculation will be predicated upon, you know, an employee having worked a paid holiday, comma, vacation, comma, et cetera, period. That et cetera at the end of the sentence changes the whole nature of the sentence, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of interpreting a contract. The first example I gave, holidays, paid holidays and vacation, means to include one is to exclude others. In the second example with et cetera, that means of a kind, which means those are only examples. So yeah. basically we're saying that any paid time off could possibly be included towards the overtime bill. And for, you know, an employer that has never worked with a labor agreement before, those are the sort of nuanced items that they may miss, end up agreeing to, that, you know, in a sense, now they find themselves working under a very prohibitive agreement or very expensive agreement.
Yeah. It's, you've said it before, but it's, there's a lot of art to this in addition to the science. And a lot of it is really just sort of hard knocks, you know, like somebody gets sneaky and figures out a weird way to interpret a clause. And all of a sudden what you thought was really clear and concrete has now become like a gravel pit. And, so you kind of have, you know, you have to, as you're looking at clauses, either that they're presenting to you or you're drafting your own clauses, you really have to look at it from the other side and be like, okay, like what are they trying to accomplish here? And like, what are the watchouts there? And then same thing, how might this be interpreted if you were on the other side? How might they try to twist some of these words to be more favorable to, you know, their position, so that every single word on that document is important and needs to be looked at that way.
I'll give you a very recent example. I was, you know, and again, after 6 years of being with the Teamsters and looking at hundreds of agreements and being in on, you know, dozens of negotiations with the Teamsters, just recently we was in negotiations with a union that had, you know, a clause in it that says, you know, management will respect bargaining unit employees, will act in a cooperative fashion with the union, you know, all sorts of really nice flowery mm-hmm. language about establishing a great relationship. You know, bottom line is, you know, when we got to the table, in a sense, counter-proposed, said, we don't agree to that language because it's nothing more than a grievance machine. Mm-hmm. In effect, you say, even though it sounds nice and, you know, yeah. and the union rep says, you know, Dave, you don't agree that we should cooperate? I said, well, what does cooperation mean? In a sense, this language basically says is the minute you don't feel I'm cooperating, that's subject to the grievance process mm-hmm. in the agreement. So the answer is no. We're right. We don't like the language and sorry, but not today. Yeah. And so that's those sorts of things. It sounds good. It, you know, the union is sitting there putting pressure on the local management team to say, oh, come on, you know, you don't want to establish a partnership with the union. But you have to be careful because that language carries weight. Everything in the agreement carries weight.
Yeah. And like you say, it's all grievable, right? I mean, unless you yes. are very specific about this is not subject to the grievance procedure, like it's all grievable. And so you have to have thought through all of that as you're drafting the agreement. We're kind of coming up on time. So why don't we, let's sum up with what are the key sort of mistakes that you see employers make at like this phase? They're kind of like just unionized. They're going through the bargaining preparation, but what are the biggest mistakes that you see?
You know, for management, there may be some hard feelings after having lost an election. And, you know, I always tell management, look, it's over. You're going to bargain. Go into bargaining with the clear mindset that you're going to reach an agreement with the union that suits everybody's needs, yours, the employees, and the unions. Okay. So go into that. And, you know, and what you've, the, some of the bigger mistakes based off of that, then in a sense, is an employer doesn't go in with that attitude. They're still fighting the war, per se. That typically leads to making statements of an intention not to bargain in good faith. We'll just say no to everything, talking to employees about there's going to be a strike, the inevitability of a strike, things of that nature. So this very early on, in a sense, establishing a pattern of communications and speech that would indicate that the employer is not willing to bargain in good faith. That's usually a huge mistake. I would say not responding to the union's information request timely and completely, strategically, and we'll talk about that in later episodes, but not responding to information requests, you know, has long-term consequences to it. So this idea of, you know, while it may seem burdensome, take the information request seriously. What you sometimes find is an employer circumventing the union and still direct dealing with employees, trying to deal with employees on individual basis, trying to get things done on an individual basis. And again, we generally recommend against that. That is, you know, once the union is the sole and exclusive representative, it is, you know, you cannot direct deal with an employee or group of employees or another employee representative. Not remembering tips, no threats, no interrogation, no promises, no surveillance on union activity, and ignoring employee Weingarten rights. Okay, again, that can lead to a charge, an unfair labor practice charge at the board, and that changes your stance at the bargaining table later on. And finally, I would say the single biggest mistake is not managing the business. And that is, you know, whatever policies and procedures are in effect, manage your business, manage the employees, maintain control.
Those are great. I'm gonna build on just one of them. So you talked about, like, don't go directly to employees. So of course, direct dealing is illegal because the union's the representative. But the flip side of that is you've got to remember, like, a union is a political organization. They just won a vote, and now they're representing this group. But, like, at the end of the day, they're still also kind of trying to shore up their own support and trying to, like, figure out, like, what's this bargaining unit kind of going to be like, right? And the more that you sort of give them opportunities to sort of be in that, you know, leadership role and do that representation and help them understand, like, you are not trying to, like, you know, kick their legs out from under them. You're just trying to get a deal. You need to be able to run your business. You're going to be reasonable to deal with, as long as they can be reasonable to deal with. But, like, the quicker you can get into that mindset. Now, look, this is very personality driven. Some unions are just going to want to fight just to fight. You may have a union that's demands are so, you know, out of the realm of reason that you're not going to be able to get to a deal, or you may end up, like, having a strike, or you know, there's a lot of things can happen. But if you approach it with the mindset of, okay, this is now my business partner, I need to start, you know, working on a deal that we can work together, that's reasonable, you're going to position them in a way that you're going to build trust with them. You many times you can get into a situation where you can even, like, start talking to them a little bit about, look, I understand some of the challenges you've got with this group. But we both are trying to get a deal here. Like, let's talk a little bit about kind of how can we make that happen. You can put yourself in a much better position to get what you want and what you need out of the negotiation if you remember that this is a political organization and you are now dealing with sort of the head of that political organization. You can really help yourself out.
I mean, absolutely. And, you know, again, every union has its own distinct personality and character. Some unions will very tightly control their committee of employees during negotiations. Other unions will literally put the employees out front and let the employees themselves, you know, actually do the negotiations, in a sense, with the union sitting off to the side. So they're all different personalities. It's a matter of understanding that. And one thing I always admonish, you know, the employer to do, take the high road. Mm-hmm. Okay? Take the high road, in effect, you know, respond to the union, talk respectfully at the table, you know, always maintain your sense of control with the union. again, over time, rapport will be built. That allows you, and again, during the bargaining, when we talk about bargaining processing things, that allows you sometimes to take a sidebar with the union rep, kind of talk through an issue. They'll let you know what they need, you know, and then you can work those things out. But again, if you treat the union straight out of the chute as, quote, the enemy, that's how they'll respond to you. Mm-hmm. And again, then, you know, then they'll do what they need to do. And, you know, sometimes that's where it gets ugly.
Yeah. I think that's a great place to stop. So anything, you know, anything else before we move on to the next episode where we'll dig even more into the details of kind of getting ready for bargaining and doing it?
No, I think we covered a lot this morning, and I hope this was helpful, and look forward to talking with everybody in future episodes.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it. I'll see you soon.
Thank you, Phil.